Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you again, as we always are looking forward to these meetings. So Sukkot starts tonight, and some of you know, I'm sure, what Sukkot is about. We have a very whimsical God who decided that it should start 4 days after Yom Kippur, but that's what we put up with. And we build booths, and the booths, of course, have been given different meanings, and the three meanings the three most salient meanings are one that is a harvest booth. Back at the time of the harvest, you didn't go back home and come out again. You built a booth in the fields. Harvesting was very important. Everybody would get together, and it was important to get as much as you can out before things went bad. That's one thing. Then on top of that, the rabbis talked about the fact that in the Torah it mentions that they were people in their travels in the Midbar, in the dead desert or the wilderness, established booths, etc. And there's a lot of rules with these booths. You know, there was a very famous funny piece. What if Jews observe Christmas? How many rules would there be? How tall does the tree have to be? Can you cut it down on Wednesday? Is it okay on Thursday? You know, we would immediately embellish upon it with all kinds of rules. So there are rules for a sukkah. The third meaning is the idea of fragility. Fragility. And that's a very important way of understanding that we live in these big houses. We spend a lot of money to pay the mortgage, yet for a week every year we live outside. In a way, and you suppose some people sleep in the sukkah. Those who sleep in the rain in the sukkah are called a little bit idiots. Basically, they say that in the Talmud, you don't use the sukkah when it's raining. Why? Because there's no roof. That's part of it as well. You're supposed to use natural things that are not connected to the earth. You can't do it under a tree. It goes on and on. We used to use, you know, pines and stuff and hemlock. Now we're getting older, we use the bamboo one. But whatever it is, those were the three things about the Sukkot. But I was reading, so in preparing for this, I was reading an article which sort of surprised me, and it was called Koheleth. That's the Hebrew name, Koheleth. Koheleth is a name given as the author, Ben David, so people associated with Shlomo, Solomon. And there were three different books with Solomon. He's considered to have written Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, when he was young. And then he wrote the book of Proverbs, which was part of our wisdom writings. And then he wrote Koheleth when he was old and becoming a curmudgeon, a real curmudgeon. So the article was called Koheleth, an Israelite form of meditation. Wow. So that led me to sort of, and basically, you know, Ecclesiastes, as it's called. Ecclesiastes means an ecclesia is bringing together, an ecclesia. So Ecclesiastes is the person who brings everything together, who we call Koheleth. It's the root of the same word for kahal, congregation, right? So he congregates, he convenes. Convener is not a bad translation either. This author, Rabbi Tzvi Zahavi, says, Ecclesiastes is a cynical reflection on life's futility, the constant sorrowness, repetition, visualizations, and references to breath serve as a sustained meditation to help free the reader's soul from the agonizing suffering of life. Now, we rarely talk about the fact that suffering is within the Jewish realm, right? We don't think that the world is a place of suffering. Ecclesiastes does. So he's more attuned to perhaps that we're used to within a Buddhist context. It's a very puzzling scroll. It's long. It's about 12 chapters. It's read in synagogues all over the world during Sukkot. And and that's the real question, is why Sukkot? And that's something we'll try to deal with today and how it works in our practice. I'm just not always that good on this new computer. Everybody say, oh, you get the Mac, your life will change. It has changed. I'm more confused than I was before I got it. So it has changed. to a certain degree. Okay, let me see if I can get a second page up. I have kids who have Macs, but they never have time for their father. You know how it is? Never have time. Busy, busy dad. Okay. So, here we go. Okay. Okay. So, question asked is, why read Koheleth on Sukkot? It often is read on the Shabbat that falls during the festival. This year, we'll probably read it on the second Shabbat of Sukkot, which starts on Shabbat. The themes of Koheleth, which include reflections on the fleeting nature of life and the search for meaning, are thought to be particularly relevant to the holiday of Sukkot. Sukkot is a time, as I mentioned, of joy and thanksgiving, but it also serves as a reminder of the impermanence of life. As people dwell in temporary booths, which are called Sukkot, reading Koheleth during this time provides us with an opportunity for contemplation and introspection, which is about our lives and our relationship to God. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is the fact that the main message is that life is fleeting and meaningless without God's gift of wisdom and eternal perspective. I love that term I read about, eternal perspective. We can pursue that at another time. He goes on to say all through the book that the pursuit of wealth, power, and pleasure is futile and ultimately unsatisfying. And then those who wanted to get the book canonized, because there was a lot of controversy about whether this book should be part of the Bible canon, added something which said, well, the way to take care of this is basically fear God and observe all the mitzvahs, and that's going to lead you to true happiness and fulfillment. It doesn't really fit the scroll. But it's very thought-provoking. It begins with this basic word, Hevel HaHevalim, which is often mistranslated as vanity of vanities, and its more recent years is being given its more proper translation, which means breath of breaths. Breath. Hevel means the vapor that comes out of a breath. The main, as I say, theme is the fact that Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, nothing is new under the sun. There's a cyclical nature of life. And ultimately, the stuff that we do, it may be futile in the bigger picture of things. So he reflects upon the parallels between human existence and the natural world, in which in the natural world, things come into being and things pass out of being, right? Like a tree, would, et cetera, or a flower, or plants. And so he says, well, what do people look for when they get an inkling if the fact about things are really passing is that people basically try to lock themselves in. I talked about that on Yom Kippur, the people's lack of comfort with a change, with seeing that things are changing. So the most famous part of Ecclesiastes that you all know, because it became a great song by the Birds in 1965, is known for the passage that begins, "To everything there is a season." And the author contemplates the predetermined times and seasons of life and how human wisdom cannot change these fixed patterns. He then goes on to talk about the uncertainty of wealth because it doesn't really grant lasting satisfaction and security. You can't take it with you, as we say. He makes a very big deal about the importance and the value of companionship, and basically the importance of human relations. He talks about death and the afterlife, and then he talks about the fact that death is inevitable and encouraged people to remember their creator in their youth before old age and death arrive. And finally, as I say, there's an epilogue that was probably added on about the fact that if you fear God and keep the mitzvot, you will be able to have something that is not transient, but something that is eternal, developing, as I would call, the eternal perspective. So let me just get back to what this could mean for us today, and why it's so important in a way to take this book very seriously. So you say, this is a book that should interfere with our joy, right? Isn't it terribly not joyful to know that you're a transient being that will basically come and leave the scene? I mean, you know, for a lot of people, that's not a joyful thought, to be honest. For others, and I think something in our practice gives us this, that that might be a joyful thought, that things pass, that we pass, that we are not permanent, can be seen as something that, wow, I don't want to be permanent. I want to move with the flow of life. I want to, and there is a flow. And that flow is something that we attach ourselves to when we get into our practice. Yeah, you know, we breathe in, we breathe out, we breathe in, we breathe out. And we do it when we're young, we can do it when we're old. It's just, it's always there flowing. That's one thing. The second thing, I think, which is important about the fact that even within our joy, the same reason that they break a glass at a wedding, right? Why? Because the world is not yet redeemed. In all of our joy, you'll leave this wedding and you'll have to face the world again. So within our joy, there's always going to be brokenness. I give the interpretation when I do a wedding, I say, impermanence. You shatter this glass, you'll never put it back again, but that's okay because you move on to the next thing. So I want to put it to us today as for our discussion about the fact that do we realize that things might indeed, all of our actions might indeed, that's a very strong word, but be futile, that we conjure up a sense of power in ourselves, that somehow we can control it, somehow we can, you know, stop the flow of time and be there and be the most prominent thing in lives, this anthropocentric, you know, idea that human beings are the center of everything. This also will be an answer to Job in another important book of the Bible, where basically God responds to Job's suffering by saying, you know, why do you think you're the center of everything? God says, I created everything, crocodiles, elephants, whatever it is, you know, they're all part of the natural order. But human beings do think they're superior, of course, to all the other creatures in the world. So the fleetingness of things makes this, I think, a very, and it complements the idea that one of the reasons we are the sukkah is that we are fragile, that we have to encounter fragility. That's important to encounter. And I think that's really, for me, a very, I wouldn't say it's upbeat, but it brings me back into a certain reality. And that reality, of course, is that passing and impermanence of all things. And along the way, you know, he's cynical about all of what we call success. A lot of money, a lot of power, a lot of, you know, possibility of controlling things. So I think I find it rather, as I said, maybe not ha-ha joyful, but certainly a grin joyful. You know, yeah, I get it. And that sort of wakes you up a little bit more. And then I think, and again, this is my conjecture about what things are, is that you increase joy by being aware of the fleeting nature of all things. So you really get to the place where you say, oh, I better enjoy myself now and not expect the accoutrement of power and success to give me that. I'm not going to get that because I have money in the bank. Because that's usually because you want to go somewhere else. Everything is distracting, according to Kohelet. Everything is trying to distract you, and like what we said, you know, we realize there's distraction all the time, and that we have this need for distraction because if indeed we face the reality of our fleeting nature and the fact that in the speck of history, you know, our lives are, you know, what are our lives? You know, they're just very short a time. It's a blip. It's all a blip. So the question: how do you manage that? That blip. Next, my next book will be Managing Your Blip, I think. But people will hopefully don't wait for the film. It's going to be a good book. Okay, so let's open it up. People have something to say. I'm sure. I'm sure this crowd has never had a problem with breaking the ice.